This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is Friday, August 19th, 1994. I'm in the Red Gym with Warrington Colescott and Art Hovey, and we are going to interview Ray Gleckler today. Warrington, do you want to start out?
Okay. Well, this is a fine experience to look back into the history of the art department on campus, and particularly looking at the printmaking area. And Ray, you've been here a long time. When did you arrive on the faculty?
I arrived in the faculty in 1961. I began here as a student in 1946, but not as an art major.
What were you?
I was a pharmacy major. A Professor Bussey was my advisor, and he loaded me up with, I took physics, chemistry, English, math, pharmacy, and something else, my first semester freshman. Plus, you had to take ROTC and gym.
You had to pass swimming tests in those days.
And it was a bit much. I dropped math, and I took an art course. I took a drawing course from Bob Grilly. And then the second semester, I sort of unofficially became an art major, and officially in my sophomore year, became an art major.
Had you done any drawing before that, or anything?
Oh yeah, and I was going to major in art when I went. Well, I was only 17 years old. This was 1946, summer of 46. And I was going to enlist in the Marines. I was working in the shoe factory at the time, and I developed an infection from a cut, and it became blood poisoning. And I ended up in the hospital. And when I went down for the interview with the Marines, they asked me what the problem was, and I said, "Well, I was walking with a cane." They said it was a fungus infection. They said, "Well, you'll be great in the South Pacific. go home." There was some talk about a football scholarship at Marquette, and also at at Ripon, and neither one of them had an art major, and so I decided I didn't want to go there. But then, before the summer was over, another man I worked for, a friend who was a pharmacist, said, "Well, why don't you major in pharmacy? I mean, there's big money in pharmacy. You could go down to the university." So really, at the last minute, you know, like 2 weeks before school opened, I got all my papers and came down here in pharmacy.
Where's your home?
Portage.
Portage.
When did you first become interested in art or develop it?
I had drawn all the time. I illustrated my high school yearbook, and I used to do sports cartoons that we would post in the library. At that time, they had crayon portraits of athletes, and then little pen and ink cartoonish drawings of them and a history, and they were in the newspaper, and I did those of the high school athletes, and I did caricatures of the faculty, which we didn't post on the library board, and things like that. I even had a work censored, one of my drawings for the yearbook that involved the administration of the school was censored. I had to change the characters. I had to eliminate the principal and somebody else.
Were there any family members, relatives, teachers who helped you develop your interest in art or Which do you want?
My aunts did a lot of artwork, a lot of watercolor and this kind of thing, and they would give me drawing books, but they didn't really instruct me in it. When I was in fourth grade, I did a nice drawing of a Boston Bulldog from a photograph, and it looked good, and I traded it off to a classmate for a deck of cards, and so I was on my way.
It was your first sale.
Yeah. But no, I really enjoyed drawing, and I always did a lot of it, and I wanted to be a commercial artist, illustrator. Magazine illustrator.
As your interests evolved in college, did you have support for your family on that, your parents?
Yeah.
Switching from pharmacy?
Yeah, I was an only child. They supported me in anything. Yeah. No, they were very supportive.
Had you had art experience in museums or galleries? Had you visited the museums in Milwaukee, for example?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
In fact, the only art I ever had, the only formal art I ever had, was in my senior year in high school. They finally had an art class, and I took it. And I enjoyed it, but I didn't much like the stuff on design. I wanted to draw people. I remember doing a portrait of somebody in class and then adding this sort of cartoonish figure to the bottom, much like a political caricaturist, and the teacher wasn't too enthused about that. But she was very supportive, and she was a good art teacher. But that was the only formal training I ever had. And when I came down here and signed up for Grilly's class, there were people in there who had 3 years of art in high school, stuff like that, from the Madison School. And I found that I could draw as well as they, and I thought, well, what the heck? I guess if I can compete with them with all their formal training. But no, I had no idea where the Milwaukee Art Institute was or anything like that. I don't think I'd ever seen an original painting, anything like that.
What were the size of the classes in those days?
They were relatively small. I don't know. It's hard to say. Maybe 15 or 20.
And there you had to choose between art education and applied art, they called it in those days, was it?
Yes, but you didn't have to choose right away, and there wasn't that much difference in the programs. In fact, surprisingly enough, my degree was in art education, but I never took ceramics. I never took art metal. Today, you'd have to take all of that stuff. I took sculpture from Meeker, of all people, who was teaching an occupational therapy section in sculpture. George Dietrich taught the regular sculpture. So the programs were almost identical, as I recall, except that you had, I don't know that we even had a methods class. Mm-hmm. We had to do student teaching over at Wisconsin High School. But in those days, it was drawing and painting. That was pretty much it. And if you took printmaking, you tended to do what seemed appropriate to your way of working, because it was one big class that included, you did an etching and you did a wood cut and a linoleum cut and a litho, and even did a wood engraving.
And who taught that?
Al.
Yeah.
In that little room.
Yeah.
You ground those stones.
Up here in the education building?
One window, no air conditioning. And in the summer, you had this big steel sink. And I don't know that there were, or he certainly didn't have, a levigator, which is used for grinding the stone. We'd put one stone on top of the other And it was nice, you know, Warren has probably done this. You
turned
it around, but then you could spin it and rotate it. You know, it became a real performance. But you sweat like a butcher, you know, and you're, you didn't really need any water, you know, to reduce the friction. Your sweat did that. Dripping in between.
Putting salt into the stones.
Yeah.
Probably injuring the process. Well, how did you, so you got into prints then at this point? You had a course with a fine instructor, and there was always a lot of enthusiasm there. How did you react to that? Did you feel that this was something that you had a particular talent for, and that you might concentrate on it?
Not necessarily. I liked Al, and he had shown some interest in my work earlier on, and sort of encouraged me to take a print course. And most of my interest at that time was in lithography. I really liked lithography, and if anything, if I specialized in anything, it was litho. I don't actually ever remember doing a woodcut. I remember doing a wood engraving, and I remember doing a linoleum cut, but I don't ever recall doing a wood cut.
Does that sort of go back to the newspaper cartoons where apparently those were lithos of some sort or another? You use that?
Oh, that I'd done, that could be, Well, it was a tonal drawing, and mostly what we did was crayon on the stone. So as opposed to the woodcut, which would be black and white and line and so forth, I guess I just liked the tonalities of it. And I had taken, Zingali taught what was called composition. And I don't know whatever happened to that course, but it was, I think it was a required course.
Yeah, it was.
And I worked with him, and he was less formal, less classical than Grilli. And because of my experiences in athletics, and then I had worked as a section hand on the railroad during the summer during World War II, because they didn't have any older guys, you know, so they had high school kids laying track and tamping ties and all this stuff. And I'd worked in the shoe factory briefly, so I had a kind of kinship to the sorts of things that Zingali and Sessler were interested in. So I drew boxers and football players and filling stations. Zingali had, we used to call it Zingali Station down here on a triangle. That was a particularly difficult thing to draw. And then Zingali Underpass on Park Street. And he, I think he sort of liked that. He liked the...
Just some of their Milwaukee WPA sort of background.
And I felt a kinship with that. I don't know why necessarily, but I just did.
Well, there was that whole 1930s movement, both in graphic arts and in photography, of course, which was part of the environment, I presume, that you might have grown up with.
I did want to mention one thing about Grilli's drawing class. Well, because he was so interested in the figure, we had nude models, which for a 17-year-old kid from a little town was quite intriguing, especially when they walked around the class in between poses, looking over your shoulder at the drawing. But he also had a male model, Bill Schultz, who you may know.
Yeah, the YMCA director.
Yeah, and then he directed the Circus World Museum. Bill was captain of the gymnastics team at the time, and he had been in the Navy, and he had done some modeling in the Navy, posing for photographers. And, you know, I mean, he was a gymnast. He was built like a frog. You know, I mean, he was very difficult to draw. He had sort of all shoulders and latissimus dorsi and pectorals and, you know, and sort of no hips and legs. And then he would assume these photographer's poses, you know, with flexing his muscles, and then he would start to tremble, you know, because he couldn't hold his pose. And Grilly would just go nuts, you know. And I remember this one day, Grilly standing there, and he says, Schultz, relax, Schultz. Let us see your stomach, Schultz, relax. And there was this pause. You do have a stomach, don't you, Schultz?
Interesting, his son is quite an accomplished draftsman.
Yeah, I kept...
Oh, Bob Schultz.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the whole family, too, is all, you know, one son was Mr. Wisconsin, and the daughter was Miss Wisconsin. But I kept bumping into him. I did some practice teaching at the YMCA as a senior, and Bill was at the YMCA. Then he was director of the YMCA in Oshkosh when we lived in Oshkosh, and then the Circus World Museum, and then Bill, his son, or Bob, his son, was a student of mine years later. So.
You mentioned Grilly and Zingali and a few other instructors. Were there any other teachers that you had during your undergraduate days who stand out in your mind?
Well, Fred Logan. But that was really, I had Stebbins briefly. He taught a portrait painting class that I took, but I had to drop it because of, I was playing football at the time, and ROTC and all that stuff, and so I kept my, during the fall, I keep my credit load down to 12 credits, and so I think I had 15 or whatever, and I dropped his class.
Was John Stuart Curry still alive when you were here?
John Stuart, my father took me down to visit John Stuart Curry. He took me down to visit Byron Jorns.
Yeah.
Do you know
okay,
Byron?
Sure.
Yeah. Because Byron was from Portage originally, and you know, because I was interested in art, my dad thought it'd be good for me to talk to him. Well, the day we were there, Byron was having his portrait painted by Curry, or at least he was posing for Curry. So I got to meet John Stuart Curry. Of course, I didn't know who Curry was.
Yeah.
I didn't have a clue, but Byron Jones was the person that was I was really interested in. And then later, I think when I started university, a book came out on Curry that I bought and read. And I realized my good fortune that I didn't at the time, unfortunately.
In terms of students who were enrolled in the art program at the time, your colleagues, were they artists per se, or were they teachers, people in teacher training programs, or how would you characterize them? And do you still have any contact with them?
Well, they were both. I'm not sure the ratio at that time, but as late as the early 1960s, the art department was about 60% art ed majors and 40% fine art majors. It's now like 95-5. And I suspect that right after World War II, it was very heavy in art ed because the veterans were looking for some kind of job security. That's a guess. I really don't know.
Now, there was a kind of break in the faculty there. You and Warrington sort of pick up on this as it goes along, but Santos and Al were the Depression
yeah.
people, and then you said you had both Meeker and Grilly as instructors, is that right?
Right.
And they had come out of the war as veterans, is that right?
Yeah. So yeah, Grilly used to wear his pinks
yeah.
to class, okay. and then later on I had the good fortune of, I had Lee Dreyfus as my speech instructor. And he was very good. And he used to come in his pinks. They lasted a long time. They were good material.
Dietrich wore his Navy uniform.
That's what I, yeah, I never studied with Dietrich. So, yeah. That's what Sano says. So, yeah.
Before we get into your graduate days here, I have to ask you briefly about that football league you were on. I want to get this on the record.
It was very difficult for me when I came down here. I was only 17 years old, and here were all these guys that were 4 or 5 years older than I was. And you couldn't get a room in the dormitory because first preference was to veterans. The enrollment had increased from about 3,000 during the war to 10,000 within 1 year. I played freshman football, but I had no place to live, so I was commuting, hitchhiking back and forth for practice, and after a week or so, I had enough of that. Then we ended up walking the streets. We would go from house to house and ring the doorbell and ask them if they had any place to live. And I ended up with a room on Kais Avenue, 2121 Kais Avenue, living with a guy by the name of Tony Gaudio, who was sort of a Zingali type, you know. And Gaudio must have been, you know, it seemed to me like he was at least 33 years old, you know, at the time. I don't know how old he was. But he was balding, and he was from Schenectady, New York. And he was somehow involved in the rackets. Had some experience.
So.
Yeah, had some experience at any rate, or he claimed to. And I remember his brother was a weightlifter. His brother was the only person he knew that had to have tailored T-shirts, you know, for his 18-inch neck or something. I don't know. At any rate, he thought I was Jewish because I looked Jewish, I guess, and so he used to call me Goldstein, you know, and it took about a few weeks to get him straightened out on that. But actually, he sort of took me under his wing and helped me a lot, and he could write well, and we had to do a theme a week, so he helped me with that.
And he was a student?
He was a student.
Living in the, owned the house? Or
No, he was just rooming there, yeah. And he was majoring in criminology because he said he knew all about it. He was just going to switch sides.
Yeah.
No, I don't know whether any of this was true. But, I bought a what they called a fingertip coat, you may remember, at the time, and he just went nuts, you know. It's, oh, come on, you got to have a gray gabardine top coat, you know, with shoulders. Yeah. But at any rate, I was very lonely. I would go for a week and I didn't see anybody I could even say hello to because most of the people I graduated from had been in the Army, gone in the Army. And that plagued me for years. I spent about 10 years or more concealing, I don't know that that's the word, but avoiding any discussion of my veteran experiences because I wasn't a veteran. I was in the reserve, turns out, I discovered working on Social Security, I was in the reserve for 13 years, which really shocked me. I didn't think I was in that long. And I got a commission here, you know, through ROTC. But at any rate, in my sophomore year, they started this 150-pound football team, and I went out for it, and there were a lot of people. And a lot of guys. There were in those days. There were a lot of high school players that weren't that big. And I remember we had a scrimmage, and Diney Mansfield was the coach, And Dainey hardly played me at all in the scrimmage. And so I thought, well, this is it. So I quit. And but you had to take gym. So if you were an athlete in athletics, you didn't. So I had to sign up for gym, and he knew that. So when I came over here to sign up for my gym class, whoever the instructor was, Maisley or Russ Grippy or something like that, said, Mansfield wants to see you. We won't sign you up until you talk to him. So I went over and talked to him, and I had been a 3-year letterman and captain of the football team in high school, and we'd won 2 championships and all of that stuff. He knew all of that. He had it on the record. And he said, oh, I didn't put you in the scrimmage because I didn't need to. I wanted to look at all these other guys because they were going to make a big cut. So then I put on a uniform. And we played 2 seasons, 47 and 48, and Michigan, Ohio State, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And we played Illinois twice a year and Ohio State twice a year and Michigan once. And we won a championship both years. We tied with Michigan. And I was a right tackle at 155 pounds. It was wonderful because I had spent my high school playing against 200 pounders. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if you know football that well, but they trapped the tackles a lot in those days. And as soon as you didn't feel any resistance, you knew that somebody was coming from the inside to block you. And in high school, that was a big guy, you know. And in this, it was a 145-pound guard, and it was like picking daisies. It was a joy.
Were they playing the single wing then still?
Yeah, we had 3 formations. We had the single wing, the short punt, and the tee. We used all 3. Where something like 300 and some plays we had to memorize.
Where did you play your games?
We played in the stadium. Most of the time, we played Michigan at Bree Stevens Field one night game in the mud. I ended up, I was the most valuable player my second year.
Were you the heaviest guy on the team?
No, the team, most of the guys weighed a little over 150, and there were a number of athletes from other fields, the Dickinson brothers, the boxers, they're both NCAA champions. One played in, one played fullback. Don was the fullback was a nasty guy. Boy, he was a tough cookie. I know when we played Michigan in the mud, he would, anybody that blocked him, he'd rub mud in. That was the most embarrassing, or one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. In the first half, they would double team me, and I could stay in, but they couldn't move me out, but I couldn't break through this double team, and they had what they called a belly series, where the fullback was always coming through those spots, and he kept running into me, and one time I couldn't get low enough, and I got hit right in the face, and they didn't have face guards in those days. And the early plastic helmets were pretty wicked because they had ragged edges on them, and they could cut you pretty bad. So at any rate, I had this face full of mud and cuts, and I was groggy, and I was standing there trying to clear my head, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and the quarter had changed. And I was standing in the Michigan huddle. This guy says, hey, what's the matter? All these blue jerseys are out there. So I had to walk back, to the line of scrimmage. It was very embarrassing.
Did you get any sort of special attention from Sessler and Zingali because of your athletics?
I think so.
Yeah. That was their pattern. They really got very involved in the athletics.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
So you had some special notice. I mean, they were.
And you not only that, but you knew a lot of other, because there were several wrestlers and boxers and stuff like that on the team. So it wasn't just knowing that one sport, it was knowing several others.
And that was canceled after 2 years, you said?
Yeah, they, Purdue and Indiana, as I understand it, had teams, but they didn't play a conference schedule. And then when they decided against playing a conference schedule, plus there was some funding cutbacks and so forth. And Stuhldreher had really, I think it was, he was the motivating factor because he was a little guy, you know. And then I think, I don't know that he was ousted, but he was, his job was in jeopardy.
When did you get to know Fred Logan, and in what way? You said he was rather influential.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I remember taking a class from him somewhere along the line, like when I was a senior. And it must have been an art survey of some kind, because we studied city planning and some architecture and things like that along with art ed. And he was chairman at the time. And so he was in and out of class all the time. I mean, he'd come late and he'd talk, and Doris would come in and get him for something, and then he'd have to leave, and then he'd come back in. And it met in that kind of lecture room in the old engineering building, a lecture room, and the departmental office was just as you came in the door. So Doris Richards, who was the secretary.
The journalism building, I think, which we shared it with.
Well, it was
on the lake.
Yeah.
Where Helen C. White is now.
Well, there were two buildings. Yes. This
one
had,
was the 600 North Park, we used to call it, which was chemical engineering.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the next one up was journalism.
Journalism, but it had originally been hydraulic engineering.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And when we lost half of it in that fire, it just went up like a torch, because they claimed there was a lot of oil that had penetrated the building and so forth.
So Fred had some influence on you as a teacher.
Yeah, I probably, I think most people would feel that, you know, you're sort of as a mentor, it would have been Al, and that's true, but, you know, I always thought of him more as a friend or maybe a father figure or something like that, but Logan probably had the most influence on me, and I was very, well, I still am, but I was very committed to art education and to a broader look at art, and I was concerned with city planning and architecture and some of the, you know, societal implications of city planning and architecture and this kind of thing. And that was really Fred's influence.
Did you go into your graduate work immediately after your undergraduate, or was there a pause?
No, I went in. There were no jobs available at the time. And I'm trying to think what the sequence here was. I had taken a job. I had a job as a student. I went around. I entered graduate school, and I had a job as a student. I checked the rooms at 10 o'clock at night, and I would go in and write down the names of everybody that was in the room at the time. And if there was no one in the room, I would close and lock the door. And I had to go up to Meeker's serigraphy studio, which was on the, well, I noticed you mentioned the sixth floor. I think it was six by the time you count the base. It was a long climb. I mean, you went all the way from the art building up the hill to the education building, up all those stairs. And then
I think it's why we're still alive.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That climb.
And in this room, which, I mean, it reeked of fumes. And I think Meeker is the living example of the, the question air pollution, whether it can do you in. I mean, he's still going strong at, 70-something?
Well, yeah, right, 74.
But it was like a... like a bomb. Yeah, I mean, it was just, you open the door and the fumes poured out. And so I would check it and I'd lock the door and I would say a little prayer that it would still be there in the morning.
What was the material that was so volatile?
Well, it was just that the air circulation wasn't very good. And when they clean those screens with solvent, and in those days, you, as a student, you furnished your own turpentine. And we would buy quart bottles of turpentine and punch holes in the top to make them into sprinkler cans. And then you'd each have all these bottles sitting up on shelves. And the safety people called them Molotov cocktails.
They call everything Molotov cocktails. But, you know, that room, it was on the sixth floor, and it was a corner room, and every window opened.
Is that right? And it still had all those fumes.
I think the fumes were coming from all of these sources, but there was always a breeze going through, even though there was no ventilation at all, no ventilation system.
But you mentioned that you weren't able to get a job, and that's one of the reasons you went. What were you trying to get a job in?
Well, I was trying to get a job as an art teacher, and of course, nobody wanted this, what was I, 21, I guess, non-veteran with the Korean War breaking out. They figured I was gone. And I actually had, I won't mention the city, I had a job, I thought, and they called me up and told me they wouldn't hire me because I wasn't a veteran. And that they expected I wouldn't be around long enough. And as it turned out, I got into this strange circumstance because I had an ulcer. And it had been treated at University Hospital, so it was on my record. And when I graduated, I applied for a regular Army commission. I got a reserve commission through ROTC. I shouldn't have. That was the problem. I applied for regular Army commission. They turned me down because of this ulcer history, but they gave me the reserve commission, and then I spent 12 years or something like that in the reserve, and they didn't want to promote me, and they wouldn't let me go. They wouldn't promote me because of my medical history, but they wouldn't let me out. So, but I was in military government after that, and I really enjoyed that, and I learned a lot. So I enjoyed my...
Were you called to active service in that?
No. We went to summer camps and stuff. My unit, actually, when I was with a unit in Fond du Lac, and they were on, what do you call it?
Standby
or high alert or something during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. When I came back to Madison, they were on high alert, in the 60s.
Where did you go then after graduate school?
Well, and I did my graduate work here. I stayed on here in Al and Sano or Fred or whoever talked me into continuing on in graduate school, and I got a job. I worked at Woldenberg's and Carmen's on the square doing advertising and window display. I guess that's when I got the ulcer. I don't know. At any rate, it became apparent that I should get out of school for health reasons. And TOMA offered me a job. They the Dickinson brothers that I played football with, the boxers, their father taught at TOMA. He taught industrial arts. And so they came down to hire a woman, and then when they realized they could hire a man, they did, because they wanted to get men into the elementary schools. And they figured I was safe. They had some questions about male art teachers in those days. They figured I was safe because I was an athlete, and Dickinson vouched for me. So they hired me. But I was paid, times have changed. I was paid $300 extra for being male, my genes. And then also they had $300 extra if you were head of the family. So shortly after I was married, and then I got another $300. Now you get paid extra if you're a woman. In those days, you get paid extra if you're a man.
Role reversal.
Yeah.
Now, professionally, what medium were you working in at that time? In those days?
Painting. I was a painter. And once I got out of school, I realized that, there were no lithostones, there were no presses, there was really no way to do lithography. And that's when I started doing woodcuts, because you could do them in the kitchen, on the dining room table, in the bedroom, and you didn't need a press. I fiddle around when I was in Oshkosh. The high school had, what did they call that, a multi-lith machine. Oshkosh had a vocational high school at the time, and they had a multi-lith machine, and you could do lithographs, paper lithos. And I did some of that, and I was very enthused about it. Al was not enthused. Al put it down because you couldn't scratch into the stone, and you couldn't vary the surface by the fineness of the grind and all of that. And I was making the point that if you were doing a touche litho, which is where you just coat the thing with, you either draw directly with grease, liquid grease, or you do that and scratch through it, that you could easily do that with the multi-liths. And I even remember showing him Picasso's lithographs that were done, not on a multi-lith, but were done touche lithos. He still wasn't impressed. He really liked to fuss around and noodle all that stuff out, and the multi-lift wasn't suited to that. But I, lithography was my love, but I abandoned it and started doing woodcuts. And then I liked woodcut much better.
So. Did you literally teach yourself woodcutting?
Well, I started doing them when I was teaching in Oshkosh. I want to get back to that just a little bit, but I started doing them when I was teaching Oshkosh, and then I took some, not extension, what do you call them, independent study courses, and I remember I was teaching at the college in Oshkosh, and instead of teaching every day, which you did in those days, they had slipped up, and I had Fridays free. So I signed up for this independent study class, and I to drive down to Madison, and I got called in by the dean of whatever, and he said, "I understand you, and they had apparently had a big discussion about this, and he said, "Well, we've decided that since inadvertently you were scheduled with a free day, and since for your professional development you've decided to do this, we will allow you to do it. But," said, "when you're in Madison, if anyone might ask what you are doing there on a Friday, you tell them you're there on business."
Hard business.
Yeah.
Did you have other contacts besides the independent study with Madison? I have a dim memory. Did you do some teaching? Did you have a section or?
Well, that was sort of what I want to get back to. When I started teaching, TOMA was the first integrated, the second integrated school district in the state. Winnie County was the first. And integrated meant that they had incorporated all these rural schools with the city school system. And there was a state plan at the time where the rural schools then had a choice of four things. They could have a hot lunch program, a kindergarten, an art, music, and physical education program, and a traveling library. And they had to choose three of the four. Well, the farmers didn't want kindergarten. You know, the kindergarten was not their thing. So all these schools had these programs. So we were hired, and I did my first teaching in one-room rural schools, as well as in the city. And the art teacher was a semi-administrative job. You were really supposed to, as far as the rural schools were concerned, teach the teachers. So we would go out and do demos. The music teacher and I would drive through the cranberry marshes in this Chevrolet pickup, and I would do my demo, and then she would do her thing, and then while she was teaching music, I would talk to the teacher about how we could follow up on this, and vice versa. And then we also try to tie this into Jim Schwalbach's Let's Draw program, which had been the rural art program.
This was the radio?
The radio, yeah. And because of those ties, I maintained quite a bit of contact with Madison through Schwalbach. And he had these sessions. You probably went out with him
yes.
to jury shows.
Yes.
And all the teachers would bring in their kids, and the rural artists would come in. So we kind of tried to coordinate our program with Jim's program. And then I went to Oshkosh as the public school art director. And again, it was the same kind of job. It was administrative plus demos. So I was never really a classroom teacher other than a high school art class in TOMA and some elementary classes. And then in Oshkosh, I didn't do any. Well, wait, I guess I taught the junior high school art classes in the 8th grade schools where they didn't have an art teacher.
But well, you were doing your own work at the same time. Now, what kind of, was that wood cutting that you were into at that point?
I started the woodcuts in Oshkosh.
What was the subject matter, basically, in those days?
Most of the stuff I was doing was more or less religious in nature. I was strongly influenced by Kollwitz and by Munakata, and the work was sort of humanistic and religious, but you know, I remember doing Ecce Homos and crucifixions and things like that. I think because I discovered the medium was so powerful, the big, you know, and I started working very large by the standards of those days. I remember doing a 4-foot crucifixion. Well, in those days I was huge, you know. Baskin was doing 5-foot stuff. 4-foot was close.
He got smaller then.
Yeah.
Were you exhibiting some of the?
I started to exhibit nationally when I was in Oshkosh. We had formed, we had a group of guys in the Fox River Valley that formed a group called the Seven Arts or something like that. People teaching in Oshkosh, Appleton, Neenah-Menasha, and it was an exhibiting group and a critique group. And we would meet like once a month, and we would bring our work together and critique it, and then we scheduled exhibits. I think we had an exhibit at the university. I'm not sure of that. We had an exhibit in Milwaukee, and we had exhibits throughout the Fox River Valley. And then Green Bay had the Northeastern Art Show in those days.
Yeah. Where would these be? In the local schools? Or?
No. They were, the one in Milwaukee was at...
the Lake?
No.
Milwaukee Art Institute?
No, it's still there. What is it? It's like a museum and gallery. I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah, I can't think either. It's a...
It's a house. It was originally a
mansion, yes. Yeah, and it's still used as a museum, and I can't think of the name.
And we exhibited there, and we exhibited somewhere else in Milwaukee. I don't remember exactly where, maybe at UWM, because this was a mixture of guys from Milwaukee and Madison.
Milwaukee Teachers College.
Was Art for All a part of that group? He was at Appleton, I think, at that time.
No, he was in Milwaukee at that time.
Oh, he was back.
He was teaching junior high in Milwaukee, and then he went to Downer, and then Downer was incorporated by Lawrence, and that's when he went. But he didn't go to Appleton until I think the 60s.
Because that was an active campus in the arts.
I mean,
Tom Dietrich, I remember, was there.
Dietrich was in Appleton. And they used to bring up, I remember a guy came up from Illinois that worked in Lacquer. I don't remember what his name was now, and he did a demo, and they had good shows there.
Yeah. What years was this?
I taught in the public schools in Oshkosh in 52 and 50, the 52-53 school year, and then I went to the college. I was there for 4 years, from 53 to 57, through 57.
And you were exhibiting your prints nationally.
Yeah.
And within the state, there was the Salon here every year.
Right.
And in Milwaukee, there was at the
Painters and Sculptors.
Painters and Sculptors.
And then there was the State Fair Show.
Yeah, right.
And then there was this Northeastern Wisconsin Art Show. The big show was the Painters and Sculptors, and they got a lot of press.
And I believe was yearly at that time.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, and color reproductions. And, I mean, they had in the roto section or whatever.
Yeah.
I remember they devoted about half of it to one of the shows with all color reproductions, big. That's how you made it. You scored in these state shows. That's how you built your
reputation. Attention on artists in the state was, I think, much greater than it is now.
Yeah.
The museums gave more space to local art. There were regular exhibits, and the newspapers picked up on it. Milwaukee Journal did amazing reviews, color reproductions.
Was it limited to Wisconsin artists?
Yeah. Well, maybe it, I suppose it included former Wisconsin.
The Milwaukee Journal started this with the centennial observation when they had these themes that they would repeat from year to year, and that would be displayed at the state fair. And so in 48, they started these shows of samplings of Wisconsin artists dealing with Wisconsin, and then they would have themes. Wisconsin at work.
Well, that
Wisconsin
was the Gimbels show.
And so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. The Gimbels.
Were you in that?
No, I never made the Gimbels show.
Yeah,
much to my
competed
disappointment.
There.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, of course, the Salon here was the for many years, just starting way back in the '30s, actually.
Yeah.
One of the important annual shows.
Yeah. And I was really into exhibiting. I remember, well, even when I was still in Toma, I remember going out to the mailbox, you know, to check every day to see whether you got something in a show or not. And I got to know, because of that, I got to know a lot of artists in the state and a number of Milwaukee artists that I really had no contact with otherwise, but because I was exhibiting with them, like Von Neumann and...
Now, you had to send off the work itself in those days
and
not
slides. Yeah. When I was married, how was I? We were married, we spent one day of our honeymoon in somewhere, I don't know, Madison, I guess. And then we went back to Toma so I could finish a painting to haul down to the Wisconsin Painters and Sculptors Show. And we completed our honeymoon in Milwaukee. My wife has never forgotten it.
She said,
I should have known that, gotten out while it was still early.
Do you think that was part of the legacy of working in the department, and particularly with Sessler, that you were encouraged to exhibit?
And I think at one time, at any rate, he had all his students enter the Library of Congress show or Smithsonian, one or the other, and they did very well, percentage-wise. Yeah, he was very encouraging.
I think that comes somewhat out of the WPA, too, the fact that as professional artists, they were paid to do these public works, and there was this feeling of professionalism in the department that was funneled directly into the best students.
Yeah.
When did you become interested in the satiric approach to your work? You said most of it was early iconographic, religious oriented. When did you begin to sour on society, shall we say?
In high school, I guess. But,
yeah.
I did a lot of painting, and I didn't do color prints because I did paintings. And the paintings, especially when we moved to Michigan, the paintings by then were small and satiric, and the woodcuts were big and I guess becoming satiric, but they still were different from the paintings. And people used to kid me about that all the time. You know, why do you do these tiny little paintings, you know, 5 by 7 inches, and then you do 4-foot woodcuts? I went to Flint. Flint actually bought me away from Oshkosh. They offered me, I don't know, over $1,000 a year more, and I was only making about $5,000 at Oshkosh. I mean, it was a big increase in salary. And Bob Marks was there. Bob Marks had taught in Madison and had then taken this job as director in Flint. And he was the art director for the Flint Art Institute, and also the chairman of the art department in the community college. And the community college was the first 2 years, and then the University of Michigan had a junior and senior college on campus. And the big pitch was, you come up here, we'll pay you $1,000 a year more, and the University of Michigan is going to take us over, and we're going to be a 4-year branch of University of Michigan. Well, this was really an ideal situation, and it was a situation more oriented toward art production. Oshkosh didn't have an art major, they just had an art minor, and so you spend most of your time working with elementary classroom teachers. So Flint was quite a change, and the attitude was much more professional from an art standpoint. And they had gobs of money. I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, they had the Mott Foundation, and I remember once they called C.S. Mott on the telephone, and he gave them $1 million over the telephone, you know, plus a corner of land of his property, so they could reroute a street. It was just phenomenal.
Mott's apple juice?
No, it was General Motors. C.S. Mott was the largest individual stockholder in General Motors. And my father looked it up. He was interested in the stock market. And I think he said he had something like $350 million worth of General Motors stock. And this was 1958.
Yeah.
And we could order anything we want. Bob said that he ordered all the presses and the art metal equipment, and he went through all the catalogs and picked out what looked good, and he called people at Madison to find out what they thought would be good, and he called people from Illinois, where he graduated from, and he put all of this together in one big order thing, and he took it into the dean, and the dean said, "And is there anything else you need?" Yeah, it was just, you know. And they built a new art center while we were there with Buick money. Bob and I went to New York. Oh, this was, they wanted to open the art center with a big splash, and so they wanted us to go to New York and go to the galleries and get big name artists' work and bring it for the opening. So we drove from Flint to, and we stopped off in Oneonta, where a friend of mine was teaching, and we got to New York and went to the hotel, and when we checked in, the clerk said, I have a long distance call for Mr. Marks. And so Bob took it, and it was a PR man from Buick. And he's, and I don't remember the conversation exactly, but it was sort of, "Marks, are you there yet?" Yeah, we just pulled in. "Oh, you just pulled in? You haven't made any commitments to galleries." And he said, no, we haven't been to anywhere. We just got to the hotel. Well, he said, "I've got a great idea." He said, "I was sitting on the John last night and reading the newspaper, and I saw this article on the Brussels World's Fair art show, and I thought, why don't we bring Brussels to Flint, Michigan?" "And so don't do anything, don't make any commitments, we're going to bring the Brussels art fair show to Flint." And Bob said, "Well, now that we're here, what do we do?" He said, "Have a good time, Marks." And this was it. And then they built the center, and they did indeed have the Brussels Fair art show. And I remember the Flint Women's Club or something had this wonderful silver candelabra, and they had this rather ancient woman in a flowered dress sitting there pouring punch in front of this huge abstract expressionist painting. You know.
And did you have a good time in New York?
We did have a good time. It had its drawbacks, though, because one day we were there, a string of Buick convertibles pulled up with very attractive women in them, and the doors opened and they started putting on their lipstick and everything, and in came the PR man, took paintings right off the wall. He took this big painting right off the wall, rushed outside with it, propped it up next to a new Buick, and with a model, you know. And I remember Joe Burgess rushing out because they had the painting upside down. "She got the painting upside down." This guy didn't seem to bother him too much. And Joe said, "You know, you're going to look silly in a national magazine with this painting upside down." Oh, oh, oh. So it was that kind of thing. And I started doing big sort of woodcuts there. And then I was only there a year because we realized that it wasn't going to become part of the University of Michigan. And all of us, how many were there? One, two, three, four of us left. Yeah. Marks, and wait a minute. Yeah, I think four of us left.
He went to New York.
He went to Syracuse.
SUNY.
No, it's Syracuse at that. Yeah.
Syracuse.
Yeah, because. And I went to Eastern Michigan, and DeVore went to Cranbrook, and Joe Burgess went someplace else, and Doug Warner, the sculptor, stayed, and he's still there. Mm-hmm. But
I was in Europe at the time of Sessler's death, so I'm not sure of some of the activities. Then to fill in, were you called in at that time to take over his classes?
Yeah, yeah. But I came here, this is all his history keeps me here. We were in Ypsilanti at Eastern Michigan, and we didn't really like Michigan that much. My kids were just starting school. I had three kids. My father died in 1960 in the fall, and I'm an only child. My mother was left, you know, there was nobody to really look after her living in Portage. We were looking to put some roots down somewhere. And by then, I had started teaching printmaking. I taught printmaking and graphic design at Eastern Michigan, plus art ed. But all this time, I was hired as the art ed person. I was the artist teacher, which was the big thing in those days. And that was changing. The art ed people were becoming more interested in research and writing, publishing. Whereas before, they thought it was great that you had these people who were studio people and exhibited and also taught art ed. But that was ending. And so I decided that I would go back to Madison and I would get an MFA. I just had a master's degree. And I worked on arrangement to be a TA. I don't know where the hell we were trying to get the money to live. I mean, three kids, everything. And at the last minute, Hardy Naseth left to work on his PhD at Penn State, and John Wilde was chairman, and John called and said, or Fred called, I don't know, one or the other, said, would you be willing to teach full-time for us? And I said, well, of course. I mean, this was like a godsend. Because Hardy's gone, you can take his place. So I came to take Hardy's place. And I was here. Then he extended it a year. So I was here 2 years. And then they hired me over some opposition. I think Warrington interceded for me. But they hired me to teach art education. That was part of the compromise, I guess. I don't know why. I guess they were reluctant to hire their own graduates, or there were a number of reasons.
Yeah, that always was an issue. I mean, yeah. It was at the earlier days, I guess because a number of former graduates had been hired, and there was the feeling that we should not do that. We
yeah.
should bring in other resources. So
yeah.
there was that.
And then when Al died, I was trying to remember this last night. I taught litho and relief printing. I don't know what class I taught. It didn't involve etching. It was relief printmaking and litho. And Steve French also took over one of the classes. And I did that in addition to my regular teaching load. And then Steve left. He ran into some trouble draping a nude model in an American flag at the Milwaukee Art Institute or Milwaukee Art Museum, not realizing that it was the Veterans Memorial Art Museum. And that created quite a bit of interest in the Milwaukee paper.
He went on to a successful career in the administration of art.
Was he told to leave, or what, did he leave on
No,
his
he
own?
Left on his own.
Yeah. He had a good offer from California.
And then, so then there was some talk of my teaching woodcut and litho, and I didn't really want to teach litho. I really didn't think I knew that much about it. I had been away from it so long. And it also would have meant almost a total commitment to printmaking, and I liked art education. I really wanted to, in some way, retain that contact. So I said, no, I'll teach relief, and then we hired Jack.
Jack who?
Damer.
And which was very fortunate, because Jack could, I mean, he could print stuff that we just couldn't print. I mean, he was extremely well trained technically, and he probably technically knew more about litho than Al did, I think. I don't know. But I was in a bad position, because I hadn't done any litho and I hadn't taught it in years. And in those days, everybody had some, they were like a bunch of alchemists. George O'Connell came back from Belgium and told us about the blowtorch method, where you burn the stone with a blowtorch so the grease sinks in and all this stuff. And all these people came, we had grad students from Milwaukee, and they didn't do their own printing down there. Von Neumann used to print for them, so they didn't know much about printing. But they did all these touche things and all this subtle stuff, and then I was supposed to show them how to print it. I didn't want to do that. And that's when the whole specialization thing began, because then Jack was in litho and I was in relief, and Dean was in serigraphy and you were in etching.
So before that, you had more or less all taught all different
things. Well, there were really two print classes. Al was teaching intaglio and relief and litho. And then Meeker was teaching just the serigraphy. So there was this bunch of things that Al taught, and then the one thing. And suddenly Al was gone. And Ray came in and he was doing the relief and the litho. I mean, not really wanting to do it, but doing it, the Meeker. And then, I guess earlier, I had, Sessler had spun off the intaglio and I'd taken that.
Yeah.
So I was in place to teach the intaglio.
Yeah.
And so then a solution was to hire a specialist in litho. And I think we hired very well. We got this guy right out of school, but very talented. And we suddenly, almost accidentally, we had a department within a department and of specialists teaching really the thing that they did themselves and that they were particularly interested in. And I think the thing began to take off from that.
Was that something, to either of your knowledge, that happened in other art departments around the country as well, do you know?
No, I don't think it really was an accident. It was a kind of a tragic accident because Al was a young man and his death was just a tragedy. But that's what came out of it. And I think in most departments the print remained under a head. One person who was teaching a lot of things. I think our idea began to circulate, and it began to happen other places to really divide printmaking into the various specialized areas.
I remember Jerry Purdy, who was here for a while, talking about at Illinois, they set up a litho press next to the furnace somewhere in the bowels of the art department, because it just wasn't taught. What was his name? Taught etching. Chaffetz. Started with a C. Chesney. He was etching, and then Lisansky at Iowa. I don't know what, Pizzotti was in Indiana, but I don't know what was going on there.
Did this have any connection at all with the commercial art world at the time? Techniques which were being used in that area, advertising and so forth?
Well, I suppose, silk screen grew out of the, and Dean had worked as a commercial silk screener in Chicago.
Deemer have any background?
No.
No, as a matter of fact, in lithography, it was the opposite thing. Commercial, stone litho was fading out of the commercial printing. The litho work in the schools was encouraged because these printing businesses gave equipment and stones. They were giving them away to the schools for a tax deduction.
People were using them for sidewalks in Milwaukee.
For anchors on fishing boats.
Treacherous sidewalks.
No, one thing that emerged, not only the sort of diversity of the technology, but by the same token, there was a sort of worldview that began to show itself in terms of the people that were here. I mean, if you look at Al's world, it's sort of a special little place that you go to, and it's distinct, and then there's yours and Warrington's.
Well, there was a change occurring in the department. Up until the 60s, I think the department was pretty much controlled by the Milwaukee people. Sessler, Zingali, Viertaler, Logan, so forth. And with very strong ties, because Logan was chairman for years, with very strong ties to the dean's office and the School of Education. And I know that somewhere in there it was 60% art ed and 40% studio of fine arts. Then there was a movement, and Fred went to Africa or somewhere. And then when he came back, he was still interested in being chairman, but there was a movement afoot to get Harvey Littleton in as chairman, and a more, perhaps less conservative element within the department. And Harvey was elected. And Harvey had money from his father, which was, I think, like $5,000, which in those days was a lot of money, as a kind of sinking fund, something, to use as seed money, that's what Harvey called it. And Harvey encouraged people to exhibit nationally. He really expanded the vision, I think. And he would pay for crating and shipping work around, which was a very expensive proposition for painters and so forth. The printmakers wasn't much. Or if somebody had a one-person show, there was money to support this. And I think that there was a change. There was a change in direction in the department. People were afraid. Logan and Stiles were good friends, and people were afraid that if Fred was reelected, that the School of Education would still be a very dominant influence in the matters of the department, and this was a way of kind of moving away from the School of Ed. And Harvey, throughout his tenure, was always trying to become part of LNS.
Yes.
And things like that, get out of the School of Ed.
Harvey had a definite agenda.
Yeah.
And I think, and he had strong support within the department from the people that didn't have the art ed connection and that felt nervous and somewhat repressed by being in the School of Education. And the School of Education, in my day, you know, at one time before then, I had been chair, and the School of Education was very supportive. And the dean was Dean Fowkes, who was a very strong, active dean who wanted an art department, and who saw the coexistence and the supportive roles of art and art ed. As a matter of fact, we were called at that time the Department of Art and Art Education. Then, with Dean Stiles, it became something different. And so there was more opposition to Stiles, who was rather remote and not interested in art. And Fred was sort of tied into Stiles because he had gotten School of Education support for his research. And so there was this contention within the department, and Harvey won and was a very aggressive chair. And he initiated a lot of things, one of which, with his own money, he rented an apartment
campus. Yeah.
And he funded and we had an art department club in this private club. We would have a luncheon once a week, and he would invite people from the president's office. He would invite a dean, he would invite a Nobel laureate, and it was a kind of a high period.
Yeah.
The art department was out moving among the shakers and breakers of the university. And he took on Stiles. He took on Stiles, and he was at least partially responsible for Stiles' resignation. I mean, that's probably a story that Harvey should tell. But it was a very lively period.
Sounds like he was able to turn Stiles. Is that right?
He turned the style, yeah, or climbed the style. I don't know.
Well, also, we had, when was it, the 1970s, we had the Midwest College Art Conference here, and we had just moved into the new building, and in the new building, the entire West side of the building was all dedicated to printmaking or graphic design, except one room. And we were always trying to get that one room because then we could have the only block-long print department in the country. And we had a lot of, instead of putting money into a fancy building, we put money into equipment. And so we had a pretty impressive array of studios and equipment and brought these people in from all over the country to see it. And instead of bringing in guest speakers, I was the head of the thing. I was vice president of Midwest Art or something at the time. We decided that we would have the staff, faculty, do demos and talks and everything. So it cost us very little money. And we made a lot of money on the conference, which impressed the Midwest Conference. But it also became a showplace for our faculty and our new equipment and everything. So I think it was a good PR thing.
When was this house operating, where you had the people invited them for lunch? Was that in the same period, early 70s?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Harvey was chairman when we had that, when we had the Midwest Conference. And I believe at that time, whatever date that was, yeah, we had the apartment. It was an apartment, yeah, on West Johnson.
So the specialization started in the early to mid 1960s, and it sounds like the art department was doing very well then in the early 70s.
Yeah, the department was flourishing. Yeah. I'd say the whole department was flourishing. And we had the new building, the humanities building, which is ironic kind of looking at it today, but when it was new and fully equipped, it was state of the art. So it, the department was on the way up, and it's been slowly building, and suddenly it began to take off. Our graduate program expanded drastically.
What made it so that it could take off? Was it the building plus the veteran status of the faculty, or support, financial support?
Well, what do you think, Brian?
I don't know. I was looking through a list of graduates, and the only place I could find in printmaking, and the only place I could find anything was in my professional activities reports. And the first year that I had made any note of it was 1969, and these names don't mean anything to you, but Sabra Siegel, Rand Robin, Michiko Iwaki, Lev Mills, Bob Kleinschmidt, Susan Tawartha, Philip Robbie, Bethia Bramer, Marvin Shrimp, Mayhew Sneed, Cynthia Loughran, and Shirley Swain. And I think every one of those people, with the exception maybe one or two, became college print teachers. And this was 1969. And there were probably others. These were just people whose committee I happened to be on.
Yeah.
So we really seeded the country with print professors that came from Madison.
Over the course of both of your careers here, the graduate students, were there more from Wisconsin initially and more nationally and internationally later on, or is there any pattern where the students came from in their training?
Well, initially, they were very much from within the state. Initially, for me, which started in 1949. And the graduate program drew largely from within the state, but with the exception of the Chicago area and the New York area. We had groups of students who early on came from those two urban centers. And then that began to build, and our graduate students began to come from all over the country. I think Wisconsin was a bargain in terms of the tuition. You know, I think it still is, but the out-of-state tuition was not excessive. And so we did draw on a national basis. And I guess that's been shrinking lately.
Well, we had, prior to the formation of the TA union, there was an arrangement where if someone were a lab assistant or a project assistant or a TA, they'd get tuition remission. So
that's right.
Made it attractive to out-of-state students. And in those days, there was a time when I think we had 40 TAs,
yeah,
in the art department.
Wow.
Before unionization. Oh. And I'm in favor of unionization.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it sound like I'm opposed to it. I don't think that arrangement was very good, because you picked up people out of the hall and they were really beholden to the faculty. It wasn't a good arrangement. At any rate, there were about 40 of them, and they would all get tuition remission if they were out of state. and he only taught one class.
And then there were simply scholarships that got tuition remission. I mean, we were given, the department was given a number of these out-of-state tuition remissions.
And the opposite is true now. We're really hurting because we really have nothing to offer unless they can make the cut to become a TA. But we can't, there's no predictability to that. So we really have difficulty recruiting. I mean, we could have Alvarez working for us, and we still wouldn't be able to get these people because we don't have any money.
What did student uprisings of the late 60s, early 70s, did they have any impact on the art department in terms of actual involvement in the happenings on campus, or in terms of recruiting and image of the department, that you can make a guess at?
They certainly had an impact, yes. Whether it kept people away or not.
Well, what kind of impact did it have? Or what happened? How involved was the art department in the role?
Well, I think that especially in the print area, there were a number of themes that dealt with that in people's work. Weege was very active. Did a piece on the big fence along when they were building the humanities building, and did a number of prints that shocked people. I remember teaching a class with a state trooper, state militia guy, sitting in the corner. My room has a fire door that opens up to the outside so they can run a hose in there in case of fire. And he would sit up there with that door open and a walkie-talkie watching what was going on and reporting it in, all the student movement on campus.
There was tear gas in the humanities building. And because the humanities, it has a system of refurbished air rather than air conditioning, so the air keeps circulating within the building and it goes through filters. And so there was a disturbance outside the building. A tear gas got into the system and it remained in there for 2 weeks. So the building was uninhabitable for 1 week, and then very teary for the second week. Too much either.
I don't know, really. I would think so. I don't know that the faculty really participated in any of the riots or anything like that. But you couldn't help be involved. In those days, they didn't have the faculty senate. They had the whole faculty met in the Union Theater. And when we would go to these meetings, the students would form a cordon, like a gauntlet, and you would walk between this long row of students, which would be like a half a block, to get in, and they would insult you and spit at you and things like that as you walked on. I don't know whether they thought that would ensure a good vote or not, but it was difficult. But I think that certainly the faculty was sympathetic toward the students' right to protest. Just what their position was regarding the Vietnam War, it's hard to say.
Yeah.